And no matter what the Israelis do, you know, and they said already what their program is: genocide, transfer, or starvation. That's Mordechai, the commander of the West Bank.
There are some detachments in the Israeli army, I don't know whether it's a platoon or whatever the size is, that have called themselves the Mengele detachment.
Oh my God.
And the Auschwitz detachment. And what they have done is in order to show that they're particularly tough in relation to putting down this Palestinian insurrection.
You look at the popular education, which, by the way, any student or any teacher who is caught engaged in the popular education could be sentenced to 5 years or 10 years in jail. Why? Because the Israelis have closed the schools since the beginning of the Intifada. We don't want our people to be ignorant. We want our children to learn. So people started engaging in a popular education manner. In homes, they would sit together, teach the children, you know, and the children will be going with books, knapsacks on their back, you know, and so on. And the Israelis started stopping the children, and they arrested a few teachers.
Two women who were born in Palestine, one Jewish, the other Palestinian, give us some information and some interpretations as to what has been happening in Israel and the occupied territories. Right now on Alternative Views.
The matter of the situation in Palestine with the Intifada and the Palestinians and the Israelis has been pushed off the main pages of the national newspapers and off of the television network news in the past several months. We want to get an update and talk about a lot of things that are happening in this area.
But before we have our interview, here are some news stories from the Alternative Press.
Well, an explosive new article has been published in these times that, of course, has not been mentioned in any of the establishment media. We reported some weeks ago that in Costa Rica, the government accused John Hall, an American rancher who is the local CIA representative there, Oliver North, Richard Secord, and other big names in the Iran-Contra investigation of dealing drugs in Costa Rica, that the secret supply operation to arm the Contras that were stationed in Costa Rica were financed by Colombian drugs, in which the same planes that were used to drop arms to the Contras were used to fly drugs back to the U.S. And the Costa Rica government actually put out drug charges against John Hall, Oliver North, Richard Secord, so none of them can go into Costa Rica anymore because they're wanted criminals in this country. Well, last week, Costa Rica also handed out murder indictments against John Hall, Robert Owen, who was Oliver North's personal courier, and other local CIA agents that had been stationed in Costa Rica. This was a long Costa Rican report into the bombing in La Penca, Nicaragua, on May the 30th of 1984 that was intended to kill Eden Pastora, who was a Contra leader who refused to cooperate with the CIA and the other Contra leadership. So members of the other Contra group, Oliver North and the U.S. government, decided to assassinate Pastora. This has long been reported in the left-wing press. The Christic Institute filed a lawsuit claiming that these people were engaged in drug running and in murder, etc., which was thrown out of an American court. But after a long, detailed Costa Rican investigation, murder indictments were indeed passed down to, against Hall, Oliver, Robert Owen, and others that were involved in the assassination attempt at Eden Pastore that killed several journalists who were there at the press conference. According to the Costa Rican report, the other Contra fellows wanted to get rid of Pastora because he refused to cooperate with the CIA-led Contras, who were former Somocistas that were members of Somoza's National Guard, who were also engaged in torture and killing of Nicaraguan civilians and were involved in drug running. Pastora didn't like the fact that the Contras were financing their operation with these drug sales, so he was criticizing them, so they decided to kill him. Well, the Costa Rican government indicated that indeed it was John Hall and his friends that planted the bomb at this press conference to try to kill Pastora. Moreover, in another explosive story, they indicated that even after this attempt failed, there were other attempts on Pastora that were decided upon by Hall, by Robert Owen, by Adolfo Calero, and others. One of the people that testified in Costa Rica is Jack Terrell, a former mercenary who said that he was at a meeting after the failed bombing to kill Pastora in December of 1984 in the Sheraton, the Shamrock Hilton Hotel in Houston, Texas. According to Terrell, Hall, Robert Owen, Calero, and others indicated that they had to get rid of Pastora. He continued to be a thorn in their side, and another assassination attempt was necessary. In These Times points out that Hall has a knack for staying a step ahead of the law. In the spring of 1986, then-Attorney General Edwin Meese derailed a inquiry into Hall's illegal gun running activities, and later a Senate subcommittee on terrorism and drugs, headed by John Kerry, was not able to get hold of Hall because he was in Costa Rica and he refused to come to the U.S. to testify. There's also an interesting footnote of Dan Quayle's involvement in all of this. Robert Owen, who was Oliver North's courier, who worked with John Hall, was introduced to Hall by Dan Quayle. Quayle, Owen, and Hall are all Indiana residents. They're all close friends. And Owen was actually in Quayle's office when he was first introduced to Hall and got involved in this illegal arms and drug running operation with the Contras that was also involved in political assassination. So if this ever came out, Quayle also could be smeared with the effects of an investigation. Of course, despite the Costa Rican official inquiry, there hasn't been a mention of this in the press in the U.S.
The Nicaraguan elections are a fascinating thing from a lot of aspects, but you're not hearing much at all about it in the United States. All you hear about is the opposition group, the UNO. Well, as usual, the American media are completely ignoring what's really happening there. As a matter of fact, the electorate faces a choice of 21 parties. There are four liberal, four social Christian, four conservatives, and various sizes. 11 opposition parties are grouped into this United National Opposition, which the American press is, and the government is saying, well, it is the opposition, as if nothing else existed. Well, there was a really, in Nicaraguan perspectives, for the winter spring of 1990, has a real good rundown in history of all these various parties and how they got to be the way they are. It seems like before the Sandinistas took over, historically there were just two parties in Nicaragua, the conservatives and the liberal. And like in the United States, where the two major parties are supported by different groups of elite, powerful, wealthy people, the same there. The conservative party were represented old capital, the cotton farmers and the cattle ranchers. When the liberal party, they represented the urban business interest and the coffee growers. Well, when Somoza took over, he was from one party, but then the other party snuggled up to him, and it was pretty much one party, although a couple of people did break off and form their own parties. Later, after
Somoza was overthrown, there have been a lot of other parties that have split, and those and splits from then and splits from that, so there are many, many parties. But also been some other activities, like the Nicaraguan Conservative Party. It had a combination with Somoza, but it left to form its own group and holds 14 assembly seats from the previous election. Just running down a few of these others, there's a Popular Alliance Conservative Party, which was funded by the U.S. National Republican Institute for International Affairs, funded by the U.S. Republican Party. There's a Social Christian Party, which was founded by the Christian Democratic International. You know, there are these Christian Democratic parties all over the world. They started, I think, in Italy, with CIA and the Vatican support.
After World War II, this was a major project of the U.S. Cold War foreign policy.
Now, many of these we're talking about are in the UNO, the United Opposition. But this is an incredible thing. Guess where there are two socialist parties. One was they call themselves the Nicaraguan Socialist Party. They were an Orthodox Communist Party until recently, when they dropped the Marxism, Leninism, and now they're just socialist. But there's also a Communist Party of Nicaragua, and they are in the UNO.
They're part of the United Opposition.
Yeah, you never hear about that when the Americans are saying, oh, the United Opposition. You don't say, well, the communists are part of that.
I mean, you always hear about the Marxist-Leninist Sandinista government in Nicaragua. But as a point of fact, the Sandinistas are a nationalist movement based on Sandino, who had some leftist ideas, but he was mainly a democratic populist nationalist. And all through the years of the revolution and the years of the Nicaraguan regime, there's also been socialist and communist parties in Nicaragua that are independent of the Sandinistas. And this is not well known in the U.S. It just assimilates the Sandinistas to a Marxist-Leninist label, which is far from the truth.
Right. As a matter of fact, they're in great opposition to the Sandinistas. There are some other organizations, Revolutionary Workers' Party and others to the left. So the last election that was held there, the Sandinistas were actually the centrist party. There were parties to the left and parties to the right. But you don't get any of this idea of how much political pluralism there actually is in Nicaragua from the American press, only from the alternative press do you hear it.
Also, you don't get a sense of the extent to which the U.S. is funding the opposition to the Sandinista government. This is a current policy throughout Latin America of the United States government, is to give tens of millions of dollars to opposition parties, to conservative parties that are against more progressive populist or socialist parties. In the election in Panama in 1989, $20 million was channeled into the opposition to Noriega by the CIA. In the current Nicaraguan election, I don't know how much money, but probably hundreds of millions of dollars are being given to opposition parties.
In this Nicaraguan perspective, there's a good article by Edward Herman, who is one of our most important critics of the mass media. He says that the approach to the foreign elections, the media covering these elections, the U.S. media use three myths. The first one is that the U.S. supports democracy in the third world. The U.S. is always very happy to have support for any dictatorship. But here's a good example. The United States' attitude toward democracy in Guatemala changed perceptibly in 1947 when they passed a law giving workers the right to strike. Suddenly, the United States started intervening, and then later resulted in the coup which overthrew the only freely elected government in Guatemalan history. The second myth which the establishment media use, and swallow at least, is that the governments of El Salvador and Guatemala were legitimated by free and fair elections, whereas the elections that were held in 1984 in Nicaragua were not. Talk about sham elections. People were forced to vote, and then they could only vote for those two parties which the U.S. and the Salvadoran elites really wanted. After the death squads and the army had murdered and repressed through state terror the real opposition.
And the flip side of that, of course, is that the Nicaraguan elections are considered by international observers to be the most free and fair that there possibly could have been. The third myth that the media swallow and they spew out to you and I is that the Soviet Union has been the source of or behind a lot of these radical regimes. And of course, we should know that's a bunch of baloney by now. Well, that's all the time we have for news right now. We'll have more news stories from the alternative press later in the program. But now let's have our interview about what's happening in Israel and the occupied territories.
We have with us Barbara Harlow, who's with the Department of English at the University of Texas. Barbara and the Palestinian Solidarity Committee have just finished a whole week, a Palestine week, in which they've had a lot of speakers and documentaries which they've shown, and they've had a lot of discussion groups. And there are two people who have participated in this, are going to be with us now in Alternative Views. Edna Hunt is from Boston, but she was born in Israel. And she, of course, has an interest in the situation in Palestine. And Rabab Hadi is also living in New York, but she is Palestinian.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about how you both got involved in politics. You're both real activists now. And perhaps you could give us a little bit of a biography about how your life became engaged in the political activities that you're so committed to.
I was a very faithful Israeli until, I would say, and I had swallowed hook, line, and sinker the Zionist government lines until, I would say, the Yom Kippur War. And that began to open my eyes to the realities of what the aims of the Israeli government and people was.
And this was when?
And that
what
was
years?
In 1973.
Okay.
I didn't become really super active until the really the Lebanon War broke out in 1982. And it was then that I shifted into high gear, because it seemed to me that what happened on the Lebanon border and the invasion of Lebanon and all the rather nasty events that ensued from that invasion had to be counteracted, because it was a formidable pack of lies. And it was to me also because I came to know some of the people who were in Israel opposed to that invasion. But it became clear to me that I had to give much more time to counteract the official lines, both inside the Israel and also the Israeli connection with the United States, and a very, very strong pro-Israeli line in the United States.
What was life like back when you were growing up? You've grown up during very turbulent times.
No, I did not grow up through turbulent times.
You didn't?
No, the times when I grew up were very nice and quiet. I grew up in Palestine, remember?
Right.
I grew up under the British mandate.
Right.
And the only turbulence were periodic turbulences. It was not as continuous a turbulence as now. But the British mandate lasted from 1920, essentially, until 1948, when the British left. And during that time, I grew up, and I grew up in a multi-ethnic society. In other words, I interacted with Arabs, with Armenians, with Greeks, with Turks. These were my playmates in Jerusalem, where I grew up the first years of my life.
Now, you have you lived in Palestine all of your life?
Well,
until you
I
came
was
here?
Born in Nablus,
Nablus,
the West Bank, which was at the time under Jordanian rule, which means I've never experienced any Palestinian identity on paper, on passport, or anything of the sort. When I was 12 years old, the Israeli occupation started in 1967. And I've seen, you know, friends, neighbors, family members being arrested, taken away, some expelled. A cousin of mine spent 7 years in Israeli jails. He was tortured. And then the last day before he was released, he requested that he would be released. He agreed to stay in prison longer in order to be released in Ramallah, which is also on the West Bank. The day before he was released, the Israelis shipped him across the bridge to Jordan. They expelled him, basically.
And when was this?
That was in 1974 or something like that. And I lived in Nablus until I graduated from high school. I saw many people, you know, getting killed and detained and so on. And if you're a Palestinian, you're born politicized. You cannot, I mean, it's part of your life. It's like the air you breathe. And I went to college and, you know, I've been active all my life. I don't think we have any other choice.
When did you come to the United States?
I came to the United States in 1978 to go to college in Madison, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to New York.
Do you go back periodically to the West Bank? Or?
No, as a matter of fact, the last time I went there to visit was in 1980. I was on a summer vacation. And afterwards, we have what is called a laissez-passer, which is a passport that's good for 1 year to allow us to exit from the occupied territory. It's not an Israeli passport. It's just for the Palestinians who hold ID cards. And I send it to the Israeli embassy in Chicago. Actually, it was a consulate to get it renewed, and they kept giving me different stories, and I never got it back, so I'm not allowed to go back home. My family is still there, but I can't go back. So,
what is the latest information you have about the Intifada that's going on?
Well, I think what's going on right now with the Intifada entering its 23rd month, it's the oppression is getting worse and worse. There is an escalation of Israeli violence against the Palestinians. The problem is it's not getting reported as it used to be. I think, I don't know, maybe we can, you know, discuss this later on, but one of the starkest examples that I could remember is the question of the town of Beit Sahur, which is a small town near Bethlehem, where the inhabitants, the citizens, refused to pay taxes to the Israeli occupation authorities. They said, this is an occupation, we're not going to subsidize it. We're refusing to pay taxes. And the Israelis have been trying different methods here and there in order to bring the inhabitants into submission. Eventually, they raided the town like a couple of weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. And they confiscated the appliances, TVs, radios, irons, whatever the houses, refrigerators, washing machines, everything they had. They confiscated the beds, they confiscated the furniture. A pregnant woman, asked them if they could leave the bed so she could sleep on because she's pregnant. They said, well, you let us know when you're about to give the baby. We'll get you the bed back and then we'll take it from you. So they don't have anything, in the house. A man's TV was confiscated. It turns out it's not color. The Israeli bring it back and then they take his brother's TV. You know, and like over like between $1 and $2 million worth of appliances. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be auctioned, I think, this weekend in Tel Aviv to be sold. And this is, something that the Israelis have been trying to do, whether by, beating people up, which we've heard about a lot and we saw on TV a lot, or killing, shooting with live ammunition, plastic, rubber bullets, shooting tear gas, poisonous tear gas, that's manufactured right here in the United States, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, federal labs.
Which has resulted in the deaths of a lot of people because
not only
of that
in
tear,
the death,
right?
But also in the miscarriages. Mm-hmm. Of hundreds of women, because it is poisonous, it's not supposed to be thrown into closed areas, it has led to many people choking, it has led to many women, having miscarriages, which reminds me of something very interesting, that the Bush administration claims that it is against abortion, against women's right to choose, because they want to, save the fetus. In the meantime, they are supplying Israel with tear gas that kills Palestinian fetuses, so it kind of poses the question, what is this, where does the rights start and where do they end? Is this really about rights of fetus or rights of, protecting life? Or is it about some hypocrisy, wherever your interests, fall, you'll go along with them? Mm-hmm.
Both of you have been active here in the United States, active around an issue that seems to be remote. It seems to be in another part of the world. In your political work here, doing solidarity work, doing mobilizing work with other groups. What kind of experiences have you had in terms of making the Palestinian question or the Israeli question make sense to the people here in the United States?
I think sometimes people wonder why should Americans living thousands of miles away from the Middle East be concerned with a question like this? Don't they have enough problems of their own? And I agree, I think there are a lot of problems in this country. I think problems stemming from the fact that there is no funding for, you know, poor people to go to hospitals and get medical care. There isn't enough money going around for student loans to get an education to enable them to have a better life. There isn't enough money to provide jobs or provide housing. I come from New York. Every day when I go home and I come back, I see hundreds of homeless people, and it breaks your heart to see this situation in supposedly one of the richest countries in the world. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the United States spends vast amounts of money on the military budget. The highest recipient of all foreign aid is Israel, with $3.6 billion a year, okay, mostly in grants. And this money is going to a state that is not only militarizing itself, becoming a garrison state, is not only, you know, busting the sanctions in South Africa that supposedly the United States is trying to put economic boycott around apartheid to go to end, is not only training the drug cartels in Medellin in Colombia, or the death squads in El Salvador, or Pinochet regime in Chile, and so on. So that's one thing. But it's also violating U.S. standards of human rights in the occupied territories, killing Palestinians, and the U.S. State Department report itself said that Israel violates human rights, Palestinian human rights. So Israel is violating all these U.S. laws, the end user certificate, whereby every country that gets military aid has to certify where does it get spent. So it's not supposed to go to South Africa or to Colombia, anywhere else in the world. And the human rights. And we say that it is extremely important for both the Palestinian people and for the American people to stop this amount of, you know, funding that is going to subsidize the Israeli occupation, which is illegal by U.S. government standards. We're not even talking about Palestinian standards. And even if you talk about the homeless problem, we have 3 million Palestinian homeless refugees, 3 million refugees. If you stop this aid, you will resolve both the Palestinian political homelessness and the American homelessness problem. So we're very much in the same, you know, corner, and there is a need to bring the Intifada home to the American people and have the American people working alongside the Palestinians in order to stop this flow that is not helping anybody but is bringing disaster all over.
And indeed, you know, the same kinds of connections that you were drawing with regard to abortion, while we are denying the right to choice to women in the United States by disallowing their access to abortion facilities, we are contributing to the miscarriages, to the fetal deaths of Palestinian children over there. And by the same token, the money that does not go to building houses in the United States goes to bulldozing houses in the occupied territories. So to begin to make these connections is important.
If I can turn a minute, just answer your question very briefly, and I really would like to. It's really a mixed bag, the reactions to some of the work that I've been doing with groups. I would say that the reactions are in two extremes. There's either a lot of hostility to what we are doing, and I recently had a rather good dose of experience on that score, both from Jews and from non-Jews, to bringing, let's say, the message of Israeli brutality and atrocities of the West Bank and Gaza Strip occupation to the American public. And then I have also the reactions of intense sympathy and support, and both in financial terms and in activity terms. One of the things that I'm very anxious to do, since I'm now an American citizen, is to use political clout. And one of the things that I try to do is to persuade Americans that it's in their own interest as citizens to use their political clout, which I find they really don't use sufficiently. And in a sense, I find that the Americans don't realize that they have disenfranchised themselves by not voting for representatives on the Palestine-Israel issue. They're also disenfranchising themselves in terms of their own community needs, because they're not electing to Congress the people who are going to help on both those fronts.
Can I ask you a question? I'm sure you've talked to a lot of people, particularly a lot of American Jews who are sympathetic to Israel, and I find when I talk to them, some of them have terrible guilt feelings because the state of Israel is very important to them, has so much emotional tie to them, and yet they also feel terribly guilty about what the Israeli government is doing and has done to the Palestinians. What do you find when you talk to Jewish people?
I would say just what you reported yourself, namely that some are so hostile to any idea that Israel can do any harm, because you see, Israel is the emotional appeal has reached the proportions of cult worship. The American Jews have been, I think, worshiping two cults. One is the cult of Israel, and Israel worship is a very important element of Jewish community life. If you were to take Israel away from the life of Jewish communities, what would they have? If you were to look at bulletin boards of synagogues and other institutional places where Jews get together, the focus is on things related to Israel, either in the American government or in the American context or in relation to Israel. And the other one is that there is a cult of the Holocaust.
Yes.
Holocaust is being worshipped as a political instrument because if you truly feel terrible about the Holocaust, then you could not countenance the Holocaust that is being perpetrated on the Palestinian people.
It's incredible. You see the quotes that they use, the same terminology and phrases that the Nazis use, like the final, they're going to have the final solution.
Right.
In Lebanon.
And the thing
that is frightening.
I mean, since you mentioned that, I can tell you, I was showing it to Barbara yesterday, there are some detachments in the Israeli army, I don't know whether it's a platoon or whatever the size is, that have called themselves the Mengele detachment.
Oh my God.
And the Auschwitz detachment. And what they have done is, in order to show that they're particularly tough in relation to putting down this Palestinian insurrection. Now, this is not published in the American press. And whenever I say it to an American, their reaction is what yours is. I can't believe it.
Well,
I
read the Palestinian press, or at least and some of the left-wing newspapers. It still is a shock, even when I read it.
That's right.
But this is a curious aspect of control of the American press, and that is that there is a lot of criticism by Israeli citizens in the Israeli press that never gets into the American press.
Well, one of the curious things is, in fact, that the Israeli press is much freer than the American press. And I think it's really a very simple explanation, if I may just spend 30 seconds to tell you about it. The Israeli public is not shocked by the revelations of the press. The American public would be shocked by that. Very simple.
Speaking of that kind of coverage and the information that we do get on the Intifada here in the United States, Frank mentioned this problem for us here when he opened. What we do see is largely a foreground of children and stones. Indeed, children and stones have become the kind of logo of the Intifada. What's going on behind this logo? What's going on behind the children throwing the stones in the streets? What's going on in the houses, in the schools, even when they're closed? to talk about some of that infrastructural development that has occurred.
I think that's what's so significant about the Intifada, that sometimes has something to do with the media coverage, because some of the media that is not very thorough doesn't go after the news. They need like a sensational, you know, image, take it, you know, and broadcast it, and that's done with. But what's going on with the Intifada is not about just stones or Molotov cocktails, if you wish, or, you know, a few confrontations with the Israeli soldiers. It's really building the infrastructure for the Palestinian state. So for the state that has been declared, but it's yet to be realized, okay, that dream. It's what's going on is you see thousands of popular committees in every sphere of Palestinian life. You look at the agricultural aspect, for instance, and you find out people in their own gardens, they are cultivating cucumbers and tomatoes, you know, and so on. And you find out cooperatives also. Some of them, as we were talking last night in our program, led by women, initiated by women, worked by women, run by women, and profits are for women, some of them. Okay, all of this because the Intifada leadership, the Unified National Command of the Intifada, has said we have to boycott Israeli goods. We have to make the Israeli occupation suffer economically. In order to do so, you have to have a Palestinian alternative, otherwise people will starve. So people have been cultivating their own produce, their own crops, and they have been feeding themselves and marketing in the market. You take the question of the health services. There are countless health committees, popular committees for health services, for instance, who go to each village, refugee camp, far away place, and provide health services, mostly volunteers, doctors and nurses. Treat the injured, because many people cannot go to the hospital because the Israelis come and arrest the wounded people and take them to interrogate them. They cannot do that. They can't risk that. So you need to provide these services to the people. You look at the popular education, which, by the way, any student or any teacher who is caught engaged in the popular education could be sentenced to 5 years or 10 years in jail. Why? Because the Israelis have closed the schools since the beginning of the Intifada. We don't want our people to be ignorant. We want our children to learn. So people started engaging in a popular education manner. In homes, they would sit together, teach the children, you know, and the children will be going with books, knapsacks on their back, you know, and so on. And the Israelis started stopping the children. And they arrested a few teachers. You know, all this stuff is taking place in order, I mean, even if you talk about the court system, okay, since hundreds of people who work for the Israeli occupation authorities have resigned in response to the Intifada instructions, and they've repented from collaborating with the Israeli occupation authorities, there is nobody like police in the streets, you know, the court system and so on. There are popular committees to resolve disputes in land, this feudal disputes, disputes in marriages, weddings, it, all kinds of things. People say that the streets have never been safe as much as they have been since all this system has been put together. So you already have a judicial system, you have an agricultural ministry, so to speak, you have health ministry, you have economy. I'm not saying that we have the way we would like it to be, it's modest. But it fulfills the stage until we can develop something better. We have all of that set up. There is a whole, people have disengaged from the occupation. They've rendered themselves free. They don't want to be part of this occupation. And no matter what the Israelis do, you know, and they said already what their program is, genocide, transfer, or starvation. That's Mordechai, the commander of the West Bank. You know, genocide, starvation, or transfer. Transfer is the word for expulsion of all Palestinians. They keep trying to come up with solutions, but eventually the Palestinian state is going to be born. Hopefully it won't be born with so much blood and sacrifice, but eventually it will.
Edna, maybe I wonder if you could talk a little bit in either contrast or in comparison to that about the ways in which Israeli society might be reorganizing itself, whether around oppositional movements, contestations of to the occupation and so on.
I would say that Israeli society is not reorganizing itself in any positive sense of the word. I'm unfortunately very pessimistic about that. I would say that in general, Israeli society has moved to increasingly to the right, towards a form of fascism. The small groups of people who have been active in extending assistance to people in the West Bank have been very severely harassed in one way or the other. I would say that probably the most severe harassment has been extended to the people of military age, the men of military age, who have refused service in the occupied territories. I'm sure you're familiar with them. There are hundreds of them. They're called the gray refusers, simply because they're not made public and many of them are not thrown in jail. What happens is that through personal arrangements between the individual and his commanding officer, they're not being sent to the territories. They've made an example of about a dozen people who are repeatedly put in jail for periods of 25 to 30 days, and then when they come out, they get an order to go to the territories. The order is turned down and they sit another 35 or 25 days. So there are some now that have been in jail for several months with maybe a couple of days of respite in between.
So they're effectively sentenced to life imprisonment.
Well, for all practical purposes. On the other hand, there have been groups of people, they're small groups of people, who have been active in a number of ways. During a period when there were very serious threats of starvation to some sectors, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, because the Israelis would not allow food to be brought into the area, and there certainly isn't enough. You can't live on tomatoes and cucumbers. The Israelis organized convoys of food and really bulldozed their way through into some of the camps. And then there have been solidarity visits by a number of groups. There's the 21st Year, which is one that is particularly prominent. And then there is my very favorite group, and that is the Women's Organization for Political Prisoners. And what they do is they are particularly concerned with the 60 to 70 women who are in various Israeli detention centers. They've afforded them lawyers. They meet with the families and try and intercede for visits between the prisoners and their families, not always very successfully. And they organize publicity abroad so that people from outside write to the various authorities who are in charge of these prisons in order to avoid some of the most extreme conditions that have prevailed over the last couple of years.
In fact, it might be worthwhile mentioning here a recent success that the cooperation between groups like the Palestine Solidarity Committee and women and the Women's Organization for Political Prisoners had with the release of one Palestinian prisoner.
Yes, this was a woman named Maha Nassar. She's 34 years old. She has two children. During the first months of the Intifada, she was tear gassed. She had a miscarriage as a result of that. Then she was arrested, you know, by the Israeli authorities. At the same time, her husband was serving a 6 months administrative detention period in Ansar 3 detention camp in the Negev desert.
That's a horrible place.
It's a very, very horrible. It's a concentration camp, yeah. You know, to say the least. And her children were left with nobody to take care of them. Maha then was released. And on October 4th, which is not long time ago, she was arrested again. And people think it's because of her efforts on behalf of the Beit Sahur people who are resisting the tax war. And she was put in the Muscovia detention center, which is known to be an interrogation and torture center. That's where they put the prisoners. And due to the efforts of a large group of people, both in the United States, in Europe, and throughout the world, due to the fact that in Boston, where Edna is, a group called Maha Nassar Support Committee was set up from different movement groups, and hundreds of mailgrams were sent to Rabin, the Israeli defense minister, should say the war minister, and Maha Nassar was released. Not only she was released, but even 2 days before she was, you know, you have 14 days in prison before you see the Red Cross, 18 days before you see your lawyer. On her 11th or 12th day, she saw her lawyer because of this, you know, campaign. And she was already aware of the fact that we are waging a campaign on her behalf. Now Maha is, you know, free. She had lost a lot of weight because she went on a hunger strike all the period that she was in jail. She needed a checkup and so on. We still have the case of Dr. Riyad Malki, a very close friend of mine. He graduated from New York, from the Polytechnic Institute in New York, with a PhD in civil engineering. And he is a lecturer at Birzeit University. He was also arrested the day before Maha was arrested, because on his way to meet with foreign consulates in Jerusalem and to participate in a press conference on the situation of Beit Sahour. And Dr. Malki is still incarcerated. He hasn't been released. His lawyer has been able to see him, but he's still at Maskoubiya prison camp. He is on a talking strike. He doesn't talk to the Israelis. And until now, they haven't released him, even though we had many, many people intervene on his behalf. Amnesty International is seriously considering adopting him as a political prisoner of conscience. There are many efforts on his behalf. But the situation, you know, I mean, but we had a success with Maha Nassar. We believe that we can have success with Dr. Malki if more and more people intervene by, you know, mail grabbing to the defense minister of Israel, Yitzhak Rabin.
You need to, we must also remember that these are people that are known internationally and that have a support group internationally. But I'm thinking of the hundreds and thousands of men whom nobody knows except their families, and the dozens of women whom nobody knows except their families, who haven't seen their children except through a barbed wire at a great distance, because the Israelis on visiting day do not allow mothers and children to touch each other. Talking about Nazification.
It's terrible. Well, I certainly hope that, I mean, your efforts are small, but if a lot of people keep organizing and working, and like the organization that you're in, the Palestinian Solidarity Committee, and if the people who are viewing this program put pressure on their politicians to try to change the situation, like in so many problems around the world, the problem actually starts right here in the United States, right up in New York City and Washington, D.C. Hopefully we can take some steps to...
And Austin, Texas.
And Austin, Texas. Hopefully we can do something to end this horrible situation in Palestine.
Well, how much does free television cost? If you're an advertiser for the Super Bowl, 30 seconds cost $700,000. We raise around $3,000 to $7,000 a year to keep this program going. Amazing. But is it really free? These people who advertise, Coca-Cola, Budweiser, Pepsi, Nissan, etc., etc., they pass that $700,000 on to you in the cost of their products. Plus, they can also deduct it from their corporate income tax as a cost of doing business. So actually, you pay twice. Free TV? Ha.
In These Times has an article this week on drug testing of football players titled NFL Creates Tempest in a Peapot. Well, it appears that a local affiliate in Washington, D.C., WJLA, did a sensational expose of the racial bias in drug testing of football players in the National Football League. They alleged that Dr. Forrest Tennant, who's the drug advisor of the NFL, who's in charge of doing drug tests on athletes, has failed to follow proper testing procedures, has also breached confidentiality and had a racial bias, and that more black than white athletes were the subject of these drug inquiries. There was even the sensational allegation that three major white quarterbacks were tested, were shown positive, but it wasn't pursued, whereas black athletes were regularly fined, suspended, or got in trouble from showing positive in the Peapot results. Well, the NFL went absolutely berserk when they heard these accusations, attacking the TV station, denying that there was any bias, defending their policies, and so on and so forth.
But according to Charles Farrell, who's the special project coordinator at Northeastern University's Center for the Study of Sports and Society, he states there's little doubt that the report is correct about racial bias in drug testing. All you have to do, Farrell says, is to look around professional sports to see who's being suspended for drug use, and it becomes very clear that racism is involved, Farrell said. He indicated that of the 30 NFL players suspended for drug use, 26 have been Afro-Americans, who make only 56% of the total NFL roster, yet an overwhelming amount of the people actually suspended for drug use are blacks.
On the subject of drugs and athletes, I was listening to a radio call-in program in which a person who specializes in recruiting of high school kids to be college football players was the main guest. They were talking about the best prospects in Texas, and talk about drugs. Some of the best ones were 6'5 and weighed 300 pounds, 6'6 weighed 280 or 290 pounds. I mean, it's steroid city in Texas. I don't know about the rest of the country, but they talk about drugs. These kids, there was a special I saw on TV a couple of nights ago about what happens to these kids who start, some of them are starting as early as in junior high using steroids to try to build themselves up so they can be big prospects for college and then the pros. And they're just accepting this as part of the thing. But then they'll cluck cluck and say, oh, that's terrible, these boys doing that, but who are the big ones they want to recruit? The steroid studs.
I was happy to see a very rare criticism of our Teflon president, George Bush, in the New York Times by Anthony Lewis this week, titled The Bush Disaster. Lewis opens with the question, when has a president responded so feebly to the challenge of historical change? When has the idea of American leadership been so mocked? Lewis points out that that week in the Soviet Union, there were some of the most momentous changes in history, in which the Communist Party leadership opened the way to multi-party democracy in the Soviet Union. At the same time, there were momentous events in South Africa, throughout Eastern Europe, a whole change in East-West relations that Lewis says constitute the most significant changes of our time and new opportunities for world peace and better world relations. Well, how does George Bush respond to this, Lewis asks. He goes on a tour to ask campaign or military spending. He asks Congress for new strategic nuclear weapons systems. He demands a 25% increase in the Star Wars budget. In fact, I was watching television all that week, and every day you'd see Bush at a military installation at the same time the Communist Party was having their historic meetings to cut back on their military establishment, and you'd see George every night with the Army people. There's also, according to Lewis, a very grotesque quality to the president's performances, a disconnection from reality. The Bush defense budget, for example, includes $12 million to put improved Lance missiles, nuclear missiles, in West Germany. But the Germans, Lewis points out, have already rejected those missiles. The German politicians are pressing to reduce nuclear deployment on their soil, and they won't accept any more missiles. There's another new military planning guide that's just been published by the Pentagon, Lewis points out, that says that we must keep unchanged our estimate of a warning time of a Warsaw Pact invasion of Western Europe and keep our nuclear missiles poised at every single capital in the Warsaw Pact as well as Moscow. Well, Lewis sarcastically asks, who should those Lance missiles be targeted at? Lech Walesa, Václav Havel? There's something unreal about the continuing strategic thinking of the Bush administration in the light of changes in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe.
There's a cartoon by Oliphant in the In These Times newspaper, which shows that the domestic economic policy of Bush makes less sense than the international policy. Voodoo time. George Bush says, here come the budget. No new taxes, no Social Security tax cut, savings and loan, bailouts don't count. Cut the capital gains tax. Be happy, don't worry, no deficit. Deficit all gone.
Read my drums.
Eh?
In an article on Bush's Voodoo Economics, A Thousand More Points of Rhetoric, In These Times points out that Bush's budget for fiscal 1991 represents nothing less than a continuation of the Reagan administration's policy of reducing social expenditures at the same time that military spending is increased, and at the same time producing more tax breaks and other government goodies for the rich while cutting back for social programs aimed at the poor. Although Bush claims there's going to be a cutback in military spending in the new budget, in point of fact, according to In These Times, there's going to be an increase of $1.2 billion in military spending in his new budget, including increases in funding for every new weapon system that the Pentagon has on the table, including a 65% increase for funding in the MX missile. This is the missile that has the railroad system that will have missiles going around on railroad tracks all over some state in the West. A 47% increase for the cruise missile is in the budget, a 29% increase for the B-2 bomber, and a 14% increase for the Trident submarine, and of course the 22% increase for the Star Wars defense initiative. That is a total of $17.1 billion for new weapons programs, more that's being spent on natural resources, the environment, science, technology, research, etc. So it appears that there's no difference in Bush's budgets than the Reagan budget, and that there's been no taking account of the changes in East-West relations, the lessening of pressure of the Cold War, and the need to provide a defense dividend to the U.S. Budget instead of such a heavy investment in military spending. In fact, the voodoo economics of this involve Bush's belief that he can have no new taxes, that he can have a gigantic savings and loan bailout, he can pay off a tremendous national debt, he can cut capital gains taxes for the rich, and he just doesn't need to worry that everything will balance out. If this isn't voodoo economics, what is?
The voodoo part really comes home to roost when the United States tries to sell its debt. This last round, they had to raise the interest rates because the foreigners didn't want to buy the United States debt anymore. They're no dummies. They know it's never going to be paid. But they finally raised the interest rates high enough where they did finally get some of these people, to the Japanese and the West Europeans, to buy some of our debt. But just as the way the U.S. and the International Monetary Fund treats foreign countries, third world countries particularly, they say, okay, we hold your debt, you got to do this and this and this, the foreign countries that have the United States debt, they're in a position to do the same thing. As a matter of fact, we may have seen some of this and not even realize it. When Bush decided not to give government support to the U.S. Memories and other organizations which were going to try to develop some computer technology that would compete with or outstrip the Japanese, he did away with that, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you used to wonder, the Japanese say, oh, so, we hold your debt. We have you buy American, what do you call these American cajones. Things? Cajones in America? We don't want you to do that. I think the Americans don't realize it, but we are a third world country.
We certainly have.
At least 2.5.
That brings us to the end of another Alternative Views. We'd like to thank Brian Lynch, Eric Eubank, Kevin L. West, who were our crew people. Rob Widdowson helped with editing, and Austin Community Television provided the equipment. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Bye-bye.